All right, everybody, you know how much I love TrueCar because it's changing car buying forever. TrueCar helps car buyers get rid of the fear that they might overpay. Just in the first 6 months of this year, over 275,000 cars were sold by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network, and TrueCar users save, get this, an average of $3,221 off manufacturer's suggested retail price. When you're ready to buy a car, just follow these three easy steps. First, go to TrueCar.com to find out what others paid for the car you want. Then, register to see upfront pricing information and lock in your savings. Third step, very simple. Just print out your savings certificate and take it to the TrueCar certified dealer for a better, hassle-free car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. To see how much you can save on the car you want, simply download the TrueCar mobile app or visit TrueCar.com today. That's TrueCar.com.
Hey, happy 2015, everybody. It's Paul Mercurio. Welcome to the show. This week, Mark Kelly, bass player for The Roots. I love talking to musicians because I do not know anything about music. I don't even know how to start my 8-track player. But this guy's awesome. He's also got his own band, Oceanographer, and we talk about playing in The Roots, playing bass, working on The Tonight Show. Really cool conversation with him. Check it out. And thank you for checking out the podcast. And please, we want to keep building listeners. So I will come and paint your house if you get your friends to subscribe to this thing. We're doing great, and we want to keep building the numbers. So send around the links. As you know, I've had some really great guests. Paul McCartney, Jay Leno, Stephen Colbert, Kristen Chenoweth, Bob Costas, Sugar Ray Leonard. The list goes on and on. So spread the word. Tell people about it. And there will be a fresh paint job in your future if you do it. And as usual, follow me on Facebook and Twitter. And month of February, I'm out on the road. I am at the Baltimore Comedy Factory February 19th to the 21st. And February 25th to March 1st, I'm in Edmonton, Canada at the Comic Strip Comedy Club. Thanks for checking it out, everybody. I love you so much.
All right, folks. Welcome to this week's podcast. I like having musicians on the show. I've had some cool people in the past and got someone real cool today. Mark Kelly, bassist for The Roots. What's going on, man? Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk about sort of, you know, your time with The Roots and all that, but you also got your own cool project going on. You have a band called The Oceanographers, and you got an album that you're working on that's coming out. And tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, Oceanographer, we're a five-piece band, and we're what would we be categorized as a shoegaze rock band. Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, we have tons of effects and some cool stuff going on. We've been working together for, I guess, maybe the past year and a half. And, you know, they've gone through a bunch of different configurations, a few different musicians. And now we finally found, like, the core group of this, the set group of people. So we've been working off and on. You know, it's kind of difficult with The Roots schedule and everybody else's schedules to sometimes get things going. But we're finally on a track now to getting everything going. So hopefully we'll have some stuff out and ready to go by the spring. So people should start hearing from us around then.
Well, I hope so, man. I'm telling everybody about it. I'm telling them it's going to be a Grammy winning album. So you better not let me down. All right.
Without doubt, I absolutely will not.
Well, I'll tell you, you guys, I'm a stand up. And I always say that musicians have it harder because you're only as good as your weakest link. And it's, you know, you got head cases to deal with. It's like, I'm my only head case. I got to deal with my own shit, right? Like, right. You got to find, and you just alluded to it, like you're trying to find the right mix. And tell me about that and how frustrating that can be. And what does the right mix mean for you as the leader of a band, as opposed to being in The Roots when you're sort of a part of an ensemble?
Finding the right mix for being a leader. For me, what I always look for, of course, you know, number one are great musicians, but I also like for there to be just a really good chemistry between everybody in the band. And sometimes for me, finding that isn't necessarily on the bandstand or in the studio or in the rehearsal space. For me, I like to find that sometimes when we're away from our instruments and when we're just hanging out and just, you know, just kind of, you know, just hanging around, just having a good time, going out and doing something. Where I can kind of see if we can all vibe together. Because if we're able to have a really good sense of communication and a good relationship off stage, then whenever we're recording, it just helps to make that experience a lot better, because a lot of you have a different way of communication with each other that can go beyond just words. You know, a certain look can mean something, or, you know, a certain motion can mean something. So, you know, it's, for me, it's, you know, great musicianship is definitely, of course, the main thing, but, or one of the main things, but the other thing is just, you know, how well we can all blend together, just as far as personalities go.
Have you been in a band, you don't have to mention names or whatever, where like you're just like, fuck this, I'm going to stab this guy when he goes to get water or something?
Absolutely. I think every musician who's been in, I've been in bands since I was about 13.
Yeah.
So I've been in plenty of bands that, you know, that fell apart because, you know, people just could not get along, you know.
Is it not getting along from a creative standpoint? In other words, like the band is doing one thing and you're doing another, or is it because that person is zigging when the band's zagging, or is it like kind of more like just personal shit, like the, you know, person shows up late, they're fucking, you know, hammered or drugged up all the time, or what, is there sort of like a common thread that you find in the people that tend to be difficult with bands?
I think the common thread that I've come across, just, and I didn't start finding this out until I got older, I guess, but the more I'd go on the road with the same people over and over again, yeah, I started to find that it was really important to respect your friendship and your space of others, because it's like, it was more just that you're around the same people all the time, that sometimes that can maybe start to cause a rift, you know, like everybody's, it's like the same thing, like how you fight with your brothers or your sisters, like you're around each other all the time. And then like the smallest issues can become the biggest issues. And it might not even be because of that person. It might just be because like everywhere you go, you are with the exact same people everywhere, you know? So that's something I started to find out, you know, when I started touring on the road a lot. But I mean, but those things weren't really all that common, because most of the time, you know, when you're off stage, most people just kind of go their own directions anyway, whether that staying in their hotel rooms or going out and partying or whatever they do. But, you know, that's usually been the more common one that I've come across, is just people just getting uptight from just, you know, not being at home for a long time, a lack of sleep, not eating right, too much partying and not enough recuperation.
That girl you picked up after the gig ended up sleeping with you but took your wallet.
Right. It has happened.
Just, and I want to get more into the music in a second, because I'm fascinated. I'm not musically inclined at all, but with that, what you musicians can do, that you can hear those sounds and put them together so beautifully. But any fun road story, like where you're just like, I cannot believe that happened. Somebody lit the room on fire or whatever. I don't know. Again, you don't have to mention names, but
I won't incriminate anybody, but I'll say, I don't know, a cool road story. There's a guy I know who swore up and down that he could hold his liquor. And, you know, you might not want to put that to the test around some people, because some people want to see if that's really possible, you know?
Yeah.
So this guy decided, I don't know what he was drinking, but it was some kind of scotch. He was drinking scotch and he was throwing them back just like shots, like big glasses of scotch, just throwing them back like it was nothing. And he just kept throwing them back. And we played the show. He played well. And then after the show, you know, he was starting to get a little woozy, but he was still drinking a little bit. I guess it all hadn't just caught up with him yet. So we're in the van. We all pile into a van to go back to the hotel. And we're driving. We're hitting some bumps in the road. And he's starting to look a little green, like he's getting a little nauseous. But, you know, everybody, you know, is like, I don't know, man, I'm kind of hungry. Let's stop and get something to eat. This guy just wants to get to the hotel. I can see it all over his face. He's starting to get sick.
Right.
But now, whether or not he can hold his liquor is now truly being put to the test, because he's starting to feel sick and everybody else wants to make a quick pit stop to grab something to eat. So they stop, they go in, they get the food. He decides to stay in the front seat of the van because he doesn't want to get out. He just wants to be still. They go and get food. We get back in. We close the door. We're taking off, and now he's starting to move around because he's spinning and he's ready to throw up. So we're all in the van yelling, out the window, out the window. He turns to his right and he throws up, but The window was rolled up.
Jesus.
Oh, man. It was the most disgusting, yet some of the funniest shit I've ever seen.
Yeah, that's hilarious. The van smells like scotch and fucking vomit and turkey sandwich from that afternoon, right? That's that's hilarious. So you got like your roots seem to be from, you know, what I've read about you. I mean, you came out of heavy metal, right? And you talk about Oceanographer as a rock band, and yet you're in the Roots, which is obviously sort of soul and hip hop mixed and neo soul. So you started when you were 13. Were you like always in rock bands? And then how did you transition? How did you fit for the Roots? And what do you consider your true roots to be? Is it metal, heavy metal?
Yeah, I mean, I started off when I first started playing. I started playing guitar before I played bass. Mm-hmm. And like around the time I started playing guitar was like when, like around the time when like Pearl Jam and Metallica and Inner Sandman and what's the name, Alice in Chains, and all these bands were kind of like the big bands of the time. Mm-hmm. And I was just really into guitar, and I tried to play guitar, it just really wasn't my thing. And then I started playing bass, and the way I ended up playing bass was that a buddy of mine who had a rock band, they needed a bass player, and he asked me if I wanted to play bass. And because I said I wanted to play bass, but I didn't even own a bass at the time. But mm-hmm. he was saying, you know, yeah, man, like, you know, we're gonna have a practice like over Christmas vacation, if you want to do it. And I was like, sure. And I went home and told my mom I wanted a bass for Christmas. And luckily, Santa brought me a bass for Christmas. And the next day, I ended up going to band rehearsal, and that was my first band experience. I kind of started learning how to play bass with a little bit of the knowledge I had from guitar, but then just from the stuff I was learning from trying to figure out songs in that band. And everything we did was heavy metal at that time. Heavy metal and, you know, some old school stuff, some James Gang stuff and Badlands and things like that, but mostly heavy metal. And then from that experience, I wanted to learn how to read, so I joined the orchestra at my middle school and started to learn how to read music. And but I was playing the upright bass doing that, which I, at the time, I really could care less about. I just was really, really interested in learning how to read music. Mm-hmm. So, but still, I was playing the upright. So now I was gaining two skills of playing an electric bass and an upright bass in an orchestra, and then ended up playing in the jazz band. So now I was reading music, and I had these things going on, but I was still always playing rock music. And then when I went to high school, I went to a performing arts high school, and that's when I started taking jazz. And that's when things started to move more into playing stuff that was more on the R&B and funk side of things. And but I still never let go of rock and roll. Like, that's just always been something that I started with, and to this day it's still with me. I think more than anything, I mean, I play, you know, I love playing groove music and funk music, but I think heavy metal and rock music is really where my heart is. That's really where I started. But over the time, like, in playing in different bands and having to play different music and different gigs for money, I just started learning just a lot of different styles of music, and it just got to the point to where people would ask me, you know, well, what kind of music do you play? And my response would always be, whatever keeps the lights on. So that's kind of always been my perspective. Like, whatever, I would never say no to any gig. If I got called to play a country gig, I would play it. As long as there was a paycheck, I would do it. I'd learn the music and get my money and leave. So it's always, but that constant just need to know that this is my skill and this is how I was going to live, it made me learn a lot of different styles of music. So when I got called to join a band like The Roots, who plays, like, you know, we play everything and play with a lot of different artists, it was just, I felt like I had been put through some, I was some warrior who had gone through some training from some sensei somewhere in the world who sent me through all these levels to finally meet the place that I was supposed to be, which was The Roots. And, you know, it's nothing short of what I've already gone through in my musical career. Like, every bass that I've ever had to cover, we're doing that almost every other day in The Roots. You know, we'll play hip hop today, and then we're playing with the Chili Peppers the next day, and then we're playing with a jazz singer the next day. It's just it's ongoing. Every day is a new day.
Yeah, and what is the difference in playing the upright bass versus the electric bass? What are the challenges, and does playing the upright bass make you better at an electric bass?
I think so, depending on how you look at it. I mean, both of them can kind of work with each other. It's really up to your imagination, in my opinion. But I think the upright bass is more physically challenging than playing the electric bass, just because it's a bigger instrument. The strings are bigger. When you play, you're not just playing necessarily with your fingers. Your whole body pretty much has to be involved with playing an upright bass. Like, it requires a lot more strength than when you're playing an electric bass. You know, mm-hmm. when you're playing an electric bass, you can sit down. You can, you know, you can talk, you can do whatever you want. It's kind of, you know, it's a lot easier to play an electric bass, physically right. speaking. But then when playing an upright, like, that just requires all of my attention. Mm-hmm. I can't do anything. It's like one wrong move, and this could end up really bad, you know.
Right.
But it's, you know, even training yourself to getting to play the upright bass, you go through some real damaging periods with your fingers. You go through really blistered, bloody calluses type phases, which are, you know, kind of difficult. You got to play through them, but, you know, it's more physically challenging. But the things that I learned on the upright, because the scale is so big, whenever I play an upright for a long time and I sit down with an electric bass, it's like, I don't know, not to offend with anybody, but it's like going from a full size woman to a midget.
And trust me, I was just on the road and I had a midget in my room the other night. The holes are much smaller, man. The proportions, everything is in the same spot, but and sadly, I fit better in the midget. So I don't right. know what it says about me, man.
Yeah, man, a midget makes you feel like a superhero, right?
It's like, well, I got room to spare. Get another midget. So when you're the bass player in a band, can a bass player in a band influence the sound and the direction of that band? Like going into the Roots, and I think you joined them in 2011, correct me if I'm wrong, but do you have the ability to, assuming the other members want to allow you to do that, but generally does a bass player, and I don't mean this in a negative way, but like, can you lead, or do you have to kind of follow what the rest of it is doing? And again, this is for my listeners who aren't as savvy about music as you are, and I'm certainly not, but I'm fascinated with process mm-hmm. and people's function within a band, and particularly I know the bass is sort of the backbone of the band. Do you have the ability, generally does a bassist have the ability to affect the sound in a band and change the direction of the sound of a band?
Absolutely. I always think that I've of course, because I've been taught by bass players, but I believe that the bass player has the last word in the music all the time. Because
How so? Well,
the bass player can, even a drummer can be playing straight and everybody else can be playing straight, and the bass player can decide to drag behind behind the drummer, and it creates a completely different groove effect. Or if you're playing a chord, there could be a chord that's being played, and I have many options because I'm the lowest note. So if I'm the lowest note, I can determine the way that that chord is interpreted. So if a minor chord is being played, I can play a lower note that can change that minor chord to a major chord. And sometimes I do that to piss people off. I'm not going to say who, but sometimes I do that to piss people off. Just to have fun. But absolutely, the bass player can, depending on, you know, said bass player's imagination and. Well, imagination, the bass player can determine everything, anything, if not everything. I can change the feel of everything. I mean, a drummer can sit one way, and if I don't play in the exact place that the drummer wants me to play to create a certain groove, I can change the complete feeling of what's happening.
So following up on how you can kind of influence and play with minor chords and major chords, like, if you can do this, I don't know, but like, for example, can you give me an example just using sound? Like, in other words, like if a sound is supposed to go one way, but you can change it and then people have to follow you in a band another way. Can you give me like an example of that?
Sure. I mean, just, let's see. I mean, if for instance, I mean, let's say we're playing something that's in, we'll just say C minor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we're just playing just a regular funk groove in C minor, I can just constantly hold C, which makes the texture of that sound minor. But if I decided to play an A flat in the bass as opposed to a C, it now makes it a major sound. And I'm now going to six, which is major. And those two are interchangeable. In a, one and six are always interchangeable. So if I'm playing, if the piano player, the guitar player is playing a C minor in root position, and I decide to play an A flat, that completely changes the texture and makes it major now.
Mm-hmm. And then they have to change to follow you?
Well, they don't have to change. They can stay where they are, and I can just keep changing around all while they're still staying in the same place, and it just makes it, harmonically, it makes it something completely different.
So it might sort of be a real deep low kind of thing going on, and then suddenly it's sort of got a little bit more funk. It's not as bass, if you will, so that kind of thing, and sort of it's a little lighter maybe.
Maybe, yeah. It's just it's basically like the difference between minor and major, I guess, is that minor is a frowning face, and a hat, and major is a smiley face.
And what is one and six? What is that?
One and six, those are scale degrees. So in a scale, we'll just say in a regular major scale, you have seven notes total, or you can say eight. One and eight are the exact same note. It's just that eight is an octave higher from one. Okay. So when I'm counting up, so I'm saying C, D, E, F, G, A, B, C. Mm-hmm. So when I say six, I'm talking about A.
Okay,
You see what I'm saying? C, yep. D, E, F, G, A. So then whenever I'm saying one or six, I'm just saying the numbers of the scale degree, the note where the note where specific notes fall in that scale.
Mm-hmm.
And so for every note, there's a different scale that applies to each note.
So in the case of the roots, have you had an effect on their sound in your opinion? Have they allowed that to happen? Like have you sort of, obviously you bring your own Mark Kelly brand or signature sound as opposed to the previous bassist, and how has their sound changed with you being part of the band now?
Well, I think, the band, whenever you change one element in any equation, the sum of all parts is always going to change. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, even if we add a new guitar player, the band would sound different. I mean, we have our core sound, which of course is Questlove. He has the signature drum sound that he always puts on everything. And, and of course, Black Thought, the MC, you know, those two sounds are the two sounds that are most familiar to the public, because those are the roots. Those are the original sounds that came from the roots. But over the years, you know, the roots has changed. You know, there have been rock guitarists who have joined who add more of a rock texture. But for me, my playing, how it differs, I think, from the past bassists are that, you know, I play behind the beat a lot more. And my concept, or how I perceive groove in my mind, are the things that have attracted me. Are some of the same things that Questlove listens to and what he does. So we have a producer in common that we listen to, a producer named Jay Dilla, and a lot of his stuff that he did, I mean, may he rest in peace. A lot of the things that he did were real laid back and behind the beat, and there was a certain groove that was created between the bass and drums that, before I entered the band, I never caught a lot of that happening in the roots, and it was difficult for me to find a drummer a lot of times who understood what I was trying to do, as opposed to thinking that I was playing, you know, that I had a bad concept of time, or that, you know, or something, or that something was wrong with me. No, I was trying to achieve a certain thing, but a lot of people didn't know what I was trying to do because they weren't familiar with the music that I was referencing.
And when you say play behind the beat, so in other words, if Questlove is, I don't know, dun, 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 like where are you? You're behind that. You're behind his timing. So you're like a beat slower than he is. Is that
exactly? Like I'm creating for every attack that he may do with his kick drum, I make sure that my attack that happens on the bass may be like a 32nd note or even a 16th note behind his initial attack. So it
you're getting almost a 1-2 punch. So you're getting that kind of thing.
Exactly. That's the type of
attack. As opposed to being on his beat, and so you're essentially doubling up on that sound. You're sort of getting two related sounds very close in time.
Exactly. Exactly.
Hey, I could play the bass. Check that out. I just figured it out.
You did, man. You got it.
You said Dilla in something I read changed your life and you know, gave you like a completely different perspective on creating bass lines. over simple beats. Expand on that. What do you mean by that? And how'd your life change as a result of that?
Well, I just noticed that he had a crazy understanding of time and space. Like he could have some of the simplest drum grooves, and the way the placement of the bass lines that he would make would create such a groove that I just couldn't even explain. Like it was just something I'd never heard before, and it just showed me how with very minimal drums. Like before I listened to his music, I was always under the impression that everything just needed to be on go at all times. There needed to be loud, fast drums. There needed to be a lot of bass stuff happening. There needed to be a lot of horns, guitar. Like everybody just needed to be rocking out at all times to make people move. Mm-hmm. And I would listen to stuff that he would do, and the drums would just be playing 2 and 4. It'd be something just simple, just a boom, cut, boom, cut, boom, and it would just do that. That would just be the whole drum part. But then he would have he would put these bass parts in that were almost quote unquote drunken style that were just so laid back and so colorful that it just added so much. Like you wouldn't need anything else other than that bass line and that drum groove.
And what did that bass line sound like? Do that sound for me a little bit.
It'd be hard to
do
it without the drums to contrast it. Right. But I mean, if you bring up just about anything that J Dilla has done, I guarantee you that you will be able to find that immediately. Like it's funny,
you know, because I think part of that goes with analogize it to acting or stand up, which is what I do. I do think that when one gets really, really proficient at their craft, you get so confident that you're confident enough to take your foot off the pedal, so to speak, and not push and trust simplicity and the quiet moments and whatever, and then you get texture and nuance and a whole richer creative output, whether it's a joke or a acting moment or a musical moment. You know what I mean?
Like absolutely.
Like I'm, and it sounds like kind of a little. And if I'm wrong, you tell me. But it sounded like you were like, you know, you just said, you know, before it was like power, power, bang, being on top of it and pushing and loud and hard, and then you somebody like Dilla where you're like you can back off and do less and get more with less. And I found that as a stand-up, like now I'm at the point where, and I'm sure I can even be better at this, where I take my time more, I don't stress if there's not a laugh every 20 seconds. You let the joke breathe, you let the story breathe, you bring them in but with silence. But that all comes with experience and confidence, I think.
Right, absolutely.
And so you talked about this thing called coming up with witty bass lines, and I was fascinated by that phrase, witty bass lines. What does a witty bass line mean?
A witty bass line to me is, it does a lot of things that it's very unexpected, and usually a witty bass line to me is something that's not very complex, but it's very tasteful, like and the note choice, the choices of notes. And some of the rhythms, like, you know, you can have a bass line to me that could be just real simple, just boom, 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 boom. But see, like, the part is that your quick little, the one little sidestep, little switch thing that you do in between those attacks is that one thing that makes it catch my attention, that makes me want to move to it, because you're playing everything straight, and then out of nowhere, in one little space, you find one little space to do something that throws everything off. But then you still come back and you're right on. It's like almost like a stutter step kind of thing.
So that little stutter you just did, like the boom, boom, ba boom, boom, like that
right.
that little like sort of stutter step there is just kind of it's an unexpected gift almost.
Exactly. Yeah. Those things are witty to me. And I mean, and also like in for producers, like when people sample bass lines and they chop them up, it's interesting to me when I hear like something that's been like all the things that have been done over time, but like when somebody will take just like even an upright bass player playing something, and they'll take just one measure and take one note and then take two other notes and then something else, and in that they take one note, keep it, they take two notes and play it backwards, and then take something else and just cut off the like the front attack of it, you know. So it comes you in one bar with maybe 4 or 5 notes. You have all these different textures that have happened in the first 5 notes, and out of those textures creates a rhythm and maybe potentially what could be the basis of an entirely new song.
Oh wow, that's fascinating. Do you when you're in it and you're playing in the Roots or wherever it is, now generally does a bass play like you, is there room for you to improvise during a song? And also, are you generally, is there one particular band member that you're playing with or instrument that you that the bass tends to sort of be tracking? Obviously, it's the drums, I guess. And are you guys playing with each other within the song, or do you play with other instruments within the song too? Usually, in other words,
well, for me, usually it's the drums. Usually, everything that I do, the drums are on my radar with everything. So usually it's that. If anything, though, it's usually between the drums and the keyboard. Those are the two instruments that I'm usually kind of going back and forth between. So for the drums, I'll do things for groove and for rhythm. And then when I hear the keyboard playing something, I'll still keep the drums on, you know, on one part of my radar, just making sure that, you know, our rhythms and everything are cool. But then when I'm listening to the keyboard player, I'll try to find ways that I can maybe, when the song allows for it, where I can try to create different colors that weren't expected or that weren't existing in the song before.
So maybe you've got a great idea for a business and want to start selling your products or services online. Maybe you're an established business owner looking for new customers, or maybe you're interested in starting a personal website. No matter who you are, GoDaddy wants to help you succeed online. Right now, GoDaddy is offering a .com domain for just, get this, $1.49. You know, you can't get $1.49 for $1.49. That's a bargain, people. It's go time. Start your website today. Visit GoDaddy.com and enter promo code Paul149. That's Paul149, all one word, to get your $1.49.com. Some limitations apply. See website for detail. Oh, okay. And so you've got that. So you've got that option, that sort of room in there within reason to kind of play and then come back to one, so to speak.
Yeah, within reason. I mean, it depends. Like some songs are just really set in stone, and there's just no room for interpretation. Like that's what the song is. Mm-hmm. That's the way it is. That's the way people want to hear it, and so that's the way it's going to be done. But then there are other songs where we have a little more room to stretch out and kind of, you know, twist some rhythms around and come up with some new progressions and play some new things.
So my understanding is that you're a big fan of Bach and like think that maybe he was the best composer of bass lines of all time. That really intrigued me. Like what is, that was the last reference I expected to see bass player from the Roots. It's really cool.
Well, my father is a classical pianist, so I grew up listening to a lot of classical music. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I've listened to a lot of composers and I've listened to a ton of classical music, but to listening to, when we would listen to Bach, my dad we'd always listen to different stuff and we'd always take note of just like his bass movement and how he would always reharm a lot of different things. Like that's what it's called. It's called root motion. So,
explain that. What is reharm? Or what does that mean?
Well, that was what I was discussing with you earlier when I can change the color in a chord where there's one chord that's C minor, and then instead of me playing a C, I would play an A flat in the bass, which would give it a completely different color. So mm-hmm. Bach would do things a lot like that where he would he'd write his sense of reharmonization, which is essentially that's the basis of it. Was incredible. He could write something, and all his movement was so fluid that everything that he could that he would come up with, it was just, you know, it's just a work of art. You know, that's why he's Bach. But you know, that's one thing. Even at college, where one of my bass teachers, that quote actually came from him. He would say, you know, Bach is one of the greatest bass players of all time. You know, and I'm like, man, what the fuck is this motherfucker talking about? Like, okay, you know. Like, you know, this cat's way out there, you know, all right. But, you know, then I started to understand what he meant, like what he meant as we started going through things. And I had to do, you know, for some of my exams, we'd have to do classical bass pieces. And, you know, once you start getting into that stuff, then you really start to see what they were thinking when they were composing these different pieces.
What was so special about the playing of John Entwistle and The Who and Larry Graham of Sly and the Family Stone? In your, what made them so great? And obviously every bass player is different, but what were their particular strengths?
Well, For Larry, I would say, you know, everybody says that Larry's the father of slapping. I wasn't there. I don't know if it's absolutely true that he was the first person to do that. Mm-hmm. But I've heard conflicted.
What is the father of slap? What does that mean? I don't know what that phrase means.
Well, slapping the bass like that. You know, like when
he's got the hand does a slap. Okay, I got it. Right. With, like, all the fingers kind of going at it.
Yeah. Right. Like what you know, the most popular person to date that does that is Victor Wooten. Like, he developed a really incredible style of how to do that. And it's real percussive, and it's like he's playing bass lines and melodies and slapping a rhythm on his bass all at the same time. Like when you hear his recordings, it sounds like he has 10 hands. Mm. But when Larry Graham originally started that, he was trying to mimic what a drummer would do, because sometimes he would be practicing and he didn't have a drummer or a drum machine. So he would have to play in a way where he could mimic what a drummer would be doing along with playing the bass. So he was trying to get some type of danceable rhythm happening on his bass while he's playing a bass line. Hmm. So like that for Larry Graham, that was his thing. But Larry Graham was also a great songwriter. Larry Graham wrote some very great music. And I think Larry Graham was also, he was very innovative. He did some, you know, he's done some timeless classics that even some, you know, sometimes you hear songs like you've heard Whitney Houston sing "I Believe in You and Me," and people hear that and they think that that's Whitney Houston. No, that came from Larry Graham, you know. You know, like Larry Graham has done, I mean, Larry Graham's done a lot of great music, but it's overlooked because a lot of people have no idea who Larry Graham is. But Larry Graham has written some incredible music. He's had some incredible bands, and he definitely has been very responsible for the way that a lot of bass players sound today, whether they know it or not. You know, Larry Graham has been a driving force for bass players. And
go ahead, John. What are your thoughts on him?
Well, I mean, I didn't really get into him all that much, but from what I know of the Who, I mean, I thought that he was a good bass player. I couldn't really tell you like all his strengths and weaknesses, but I think that he definitely had a very strong sense of groove, for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, hence why, you know, I think Pino Palladino does stuff with them now, I believe, or had done some things with them, and you know, he's the same way. Like, he's for me, as far as bass players go today, he is my favorite bass player today. I'll say one of my favorite, so I don't want to just say that because there are other bass players who I think are great and I love what they do as well. But as far as who I think of now, whenever I'm playing with Quest or whenever I'm trying to play groove, I always kind of access that place, that person.
And you also back in Boston, you went to Berkeley in Boston, and Chris Laughlin in Boston was a big influence, and Michelle. Talk about why they were such big influences and what you took from those relationships.
Well, I met Chris Laughlin when I first moved to Boston. He was playing in this club called Wally's, which is it's a well known musician hang in Boston.
Yeah, I know Wally's. I grew up in Rhode Island, so I used to go up to Boston and stuff and see different venues there. I know that place.
Yeah, I used to, when I first went there, he was playing on funk nights. And, you know, Chris is this big guy, you know, he's playing this small four-string Fender Jazz. And I walked in there, and before I could even hear what he was playing, just his animation, just how animated he was when he was playing, like that alone, anybody could have just seen him play, and they would just think, oh, man, I got to have this guy in my band. Just because
what is animation when you're playing mean in terms of, like, the expressiveness, like the range of the notes and things like that? Or what does that mean?
Just visually, just watching
him. Okay, not one of those guys that's just sitting there bobbing his head. Got it.
Right, like he's everywhere. You know, this is a big guy. He's, like, all over the stage. He's right. Dancing. Like, everybody who's just watching him play, they're feeling what he's playing just because he's making them feel it, because he's making you want to dance by how he's dancing and how everything is so good, you know?
Right.
But he had this ability to just command the room with his playing, but it was just a full package. Just like, and like, just looking at him was one thing, but then the things that he was playing were incredible as well. Like, he was the funkiest bass player that at that time that I met and that I heard. Like, when I heard him play, I was like, whatever that is, I want to be that. Like, whatever that is what I want to do. I want to play like that. I want to sound like that. everything. I want to do that. Yeah. And I remember going back to my dorm room after that, and I was a completely different person the next day. Like, I didn't play the bass the same way. Like, I couldn't even tell you how I was playing before because it all went out the window after that.
Is there some unwritten rule or code among bass players that you all got to kind of hang in the back of the band and just be the guy that's kind of looks mellow? It seems like is that because it's the nature of the sound of that instrument that's the type of person? Because, you know, like, you know, you think of the guitarist and you think of the wiry guy that's sort of, you know, is genuflecting and doing all this shit. And, you got your lead singer and he's doing his thing or her thing. And then your bass player seems to have that moniker, that, you know, that kind of thing. But it sounds like, you know, Chris and you kind of have a different thing going on with that. Why is that with bass players? Is it because of the nature of the sound of the instrument?
I think it's more just kind of what subconsciously has kind of gone on for a long time. Like, usually the front man of the band is the singer or the guitar player or the saxophone player or the saxophonist or whoever. Like, those lead instruments are always the ones that are supposed to get all the attention. Mm. But in the meanwhile, like, the bass player, like, even, like, rarely, not until, like, I don't know, I guess, like, not until sometime in the 90s where we started to see, or at least when I started to pay attention, where bass players were starting to surface as, like, people that would start to do the interviews with the lead singer on MTV or on VH1 or whatever. But usually the bass player is just the one guy that nobody ever pays attention to. It's not the glamorous instrument.
Right.
It's not the, you know, like, when you get the option in middle school to choose an instrument, nobody chose the bass. Nobody. Who wants to play the bass? Nobody. Everybody wanted to play the drums, the guitar, like, you know, the rock star instruments. Like, bass has never been considered to be, like, the rock star instrument, you know?
Right.
Like, you know, so nobody ever pays attention to it. So maybe that's why, you know, we always have this need to, like, to grow our hair, dye it crazy colors, or get tattoos and turn flips on stage because we don't want people to forget about us. You know, we're here.
You want a little bit of the love. What was the Michelle and working in that relationship like? And what did you take from that?
That was one of that to date has been my best musical relationship, and I learned a lot from her. Like, first it was about my sound. Like, when she and I first met, it was I was playing in a bar in the West Village here in New York. I was playing at a bar called The Groove. Mm-hmm. And it was like an R&B night or open mic night, I don't know. But I was inside, and a buddy of mine who was the manager of the club at the time, he pulled her in. He saw her running up the street, and he pulled her in and asked her, he recognized her, was like, "Hey, you know, I'd like to buy you a drink. There's a band playing if you'd like to play." And she was like, "Okay." She comes in, and I'm playing, and then she sits in, she plays my bass, and then she took off, she left. So I was like, you know, like, man, you know, I would have loved to talk to her again, you know, nothing. So, like, a week later, exactly the same day, a week later, she comes running up the street, and I'm standing outside, and she comes up to me and goes, "Hey, I have a project I'm doing. If you'd like to work with me, I'm real easy to work with. I have a few things that I'm married to, but for the rest of that, you can do whatever you want to. Is this something you'd be interested in?" I was like, "Yeah." She's like, "All right, cool. I'll find you again. I'll see you later. Bye." And then she takes off running again. You know, so I'm like, you know, what's going on? So eventually we end up linking up, and I get in her band. And one of the first things she was teaching me was that my sound is in my hands. Like, it's not about the instrument that I play. It has nothing to do with that. She's like, my sound resides in my hands. And so, you know, I didn't understand what she meant until, like, there would be times that she...
Which means the instrument is literally an instrument through which Mark Kelly needs to express himself.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
It's the same thing about jokes, by the way. It's not about the joke. It's about the joke conveying, in a funny way, in my opinion, who you are. That's why Richard Pryor was so brilliant, you know, and
Lenny Bruce
and Bill Hicks, because, you know, there's some guys who are great joke technicians.
Yeah.
And I'm sure same thing with you. There are some guys who are musically, technically great, but there's no soul coming through their sound, and you don't get a sense of who they are as a person and as an artist.
Yeah.
Where I'd imagine what you're saying is, and what she's saying is, Mark Kelly on bass is going to tell me something different about him than, you know, Michelle or Graham or whoever. The individual needs to come through.
Right. Absolutely. Like she was really about that with everything. So, you know, sometimes I would say, oh, I want this kind of bass, or I want that kind of bass, because she would always get a lot of cool stuff. And she'd be like, nope, you don't need any of that. She's like, you have everything you need. She's like, it's all in your hands. Just play, you know? So we would do that. And she also taught me a lot about song form and songwriting. Like, you know, I've never experienced more of a free form of writing as I did until I met her. You know, like, she would make songs that were incredible songs and were full of so much color and life. And I just couldn't understand. Like, I would break her songs down and realize, like, wow, like, I can literally do anything. Like, it's not about just this traditional song form stuff. It's not about any of that. Like, I can absolutely do whatever I want to, and it's good. You know, like, if it's not just be so concerned with all the rules of how to create music and the right way to do this and the wrong way to do that. Like, she just doesn't. She never lived by any of that. And you know, she taught me so much about that, just about creating art. That's when I started really getting into writing songs more, was when I joined her band, because I would hear the early demos and when she would write stuff, and then I would be there along the way throughout the whole process of her developing this music. And then next thing I know, it would be in the studio, and this one thing that started off being one thing is now a complete orchestration of so much incredible shit. That, you know, it's like, now it's like she turned it into that over this amount of time. But it was just really, you know, it was such a process. It was just really neat to watch, you know. So I learned a lot about that. And what was the last thing?
What you took from those two people. But I'm curious about your process now. What, when you're writing songs, and also speak to how it works in the roots, like, what sparks, you know, for me, it comes from different places. So I'll get in a conversation with somebody and I'll say something funny and that's the start of something, or I'll have an experience that really pisses me off and generally there's comedy in that. Right. Is there a sound that starts it for you? Is it a lyric? Is it, do you sit down every day at a certain, you know, and write religiously? How does your process work for you individually, and how does it work in the roots when you guys are writing material?
For me, it could start from anything. I mean, it could start from, you know, I'm talking to somebody and out of nowhere, they're just a comment that they make in the midst of what we're talking about. And I just like the way that something is said. And I think that should be a song, or that should be a lyric. And I write it down on my phone, and then maybe I revisit it. Maybe I don't. Or, you know, or I hear, like, I'm somewhere and, I hear some music, something I've never heard before. Like, you know, some DJ, like, I love going to hear DJs that play music that is not popular, because, you know, I get to check stuff out that I probably would not have otherwise. And, sometimes, you know, I hear a drum groove and it's something I haven't heard, and I have to ask the DJ, like, what is this? And then now it's like that one groove, that one thing I heard that might have only gone on for four bars and it never comes back again. Just that one thing, I hear that, and now I'm getting flooded with ideas. And it's almost to the point to where I can't ignore it. Like, sometimes I've literally had to get up and leave and go somewhere, go to my studio where I record, to actually sit down and start putting an idea together, just because I felt like I was just struck by a bolt of lightning and I just couldn't ignore it. Like, I had to go and write something right then and there. And then, you know, sometimes those ideas, they just, like, one thing leads to the next. And that's the ideal situation, where I put down a drum groove and then I put down a guitar part, a keyboard part, a bass part, and it all just starts going together, and one thing leads to the next. And before I know it, I have a full song within, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours before I even thought. I thought it was just going to be one little thing, and it actually ended up kind of writing itself.
You get into a moment. Yeah.
And then there are other times that it doesn't happen that easily, you know.
And then do you write collaboratively within the roots, or is there like a main person writing and then you guys are filling in the other parts of it, or how does that process work with you guys?
There are different ways that we write in the roots. Sometimes we write collectively. Sometimes Questlove will sit with Kirk, our guitarist. He'll sit with him and they'll come up with ideas together. And then after they have laid down ideas, then maybe I'll come in and he'll ask me to put some bass lines on. And usually it's like, play the first thing that comes to mind, you know, or, you know, whatever. Like, we won't put too much thought into it, just see kind of what happens. And then other times, you know, somebody wrote something on their own and they bring that to the table. And if it's something that really is just, you know, there's no room for anything else, like it's a clear, strong idea that really should just stay what it is, then everybody just does what their part is for that, and then we move on to the next. And, you know, it's kind of like we just write in all kinds of ways. It's not about how it's made, it's just the fact that it gets there, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What's your process like on the Tonight Show as the house band? Basically, are you got to be there for rehearsal and this and that, and then you obviously if you have a musical guest, you work with them. Like, just for listeners who are know you guys obviously from the Tonight Show as well as your own music, like what I'm sure they'd be interested. Like, how does that work? What's that like for you in your process day to day there?
Well, I mean, every day is kind of different over there. It depends on what we have to do, but basically, our basic day, like usually on Mondays, we try to get as much of what we have to do for the week out of the way, just because we don't know what else we'll be asked to do as far as being on set for rehearsals, if we have any comedy sketches that we have to be a part of, or things like that. So usually we'll start doing everybody's music for every guest. We call it walk-on music. So we select a song for each artist, for each guest that's going to be a couch guest, and we pick out whatever those songs are going to be, and then we record those songs so that we have them to reference whenever their day comes on. So we try to get every guest's walk on out of the way. If we have theme songs, usually I'll do the theme songs. The engineer and I'll do all the blueprints for the theme songs. I'll play the drums, the guitar, the bass. I'll sing it, and then. If it gets approved, then we all just, when we get on set, then we all just play what I created earlier. That's another thing we do. And then the rest, after we get the music out of the way, if we have a music guest, we have to be there really early in the morning to do a rehearsal where we do camera blocking. And usually we run through the song like two or three times, just so the artist knows the flow of the cameras and we know the song and we know everything that's going on, and then that's it. And then we rehearse that time, and that's it. And then if we have a sit-in guest, which is usually, it'll be a famous musician. Like we had Anthony Kiedis as a sit-in guest a few weeks back, and he comes and he just sits in with the band, and we just play a bunch of Chili Pepper tunes or whatever songs that he wanted. And so those songs that we do for him are the commercial bumpers that we'll do throughout the show. So we'll do that, and then we play for the audience during the commercial break, and then when we come back in, we'll still be doing the song, and then we do that for the whole show. And that's a little more involved, because then we have rehearsals in the afternoon for that, and we pretty much have to go through and get arrangements for every song and record them all the way through.
So when you have someone sitting in, well, not sitting in, but when you when you're playing along with, like, what was it like playing with Flea when Red Hot Chili Peppers played? Or what was it like with Bruce Springsteen? I mean, are there some guys that come in and you're just like, man, I'm getting to play with, I'm like a kid in a candy store. Have they gotten really excited about, or that have just creatively, artistically, was somebody that you really always wanted to kind of be, playing with? I would think it's a really cool opportunity there.
Oh, absolutely! Like there, there are days when there'll be like Steven Tyler's coming in today, and now I'm playing all these Aerosmith tunes, like songs that I grew up with, and Steven Tyler's sitting right next to me and singing these songs. Those are mind blowing experiences.
Like now, is he tweaking what you're doing? Are you guys? Obviously you know the songs, and the songs are the songs, but like, are you guys sort of doing anything in rehearsal or whatever, or like?
Sometimes we are. It depends. Yeah. It depends on what the song is. Like sometimes, you have some artists come in and they say, they've been doing these songs for 20 and 30 years. And they're like, I'm playing with you guys, not with my band. Let's do this the way that you guys would want to do it and have a different experience.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And
who
sometimes,
was like that? Who did that with you? Do you remember? Was
there Well, Anthony Kiedis did that with us. He said, he wanted us to kind of just do things the way that we would want to, to have something different. He did that. Trying to think, Steven Tyler, we pretty much stuck to the script. We did everything that was, everybody wants to hear Aerosmith. They don't want to hear Aerosmith hip hopped out or, of that. That's kind of taking a risk. Everybody wants to hear Aerosmith.
Although that's what brought them back to life. It was, when they, with that collaboration of theirs,
yeah.
Right. So like, What about like Flea? What was he like to play with?
Man, Flea is one of the coolest dudes on the planet. Yeah. He was really, you know, like he a lot. Sometimes when bass players come in, a lot of times, you know, it's difficult for two bass players to play at the same time. And you know, some bass players, they come in and they're pretty much like, you know, I'll take over. Like when Sting comes, you know, Sting wants to play, and I don't want to get in the way of Sting playing at all. Right. You know, right. So absolutely play your songs. I'll sit back and watch, no problem.
Yeah.
Flea was just kind of like, man, you know, come on, we can play two basses at the same time. You know, just find your groove and just play. And we played a song, Standing on the Verge of Getting It On, which was we found just two different bass parts, and we were both slapping and playing. Like it was incredible. Like everything just flowed really well. So it's, you know, it's like it's like I said, it's about your imagination. Like he has an imagination that allows him to have those ideas of, yeah, two bass players can exist, and some people in their mind there's only supposed to be one bass player in the band, and I'm cool with both perspectives.
What was it like playing with Bruce, and what makes him Bruce? Had you played with him before? What was it like playing with him? And if you hadn't played with him before, was there something when you're playing with him where you go, oh, this is why he's Bruce Springsteen?
Well, Bruce Springsteen to me is Bruce just because he's cool than a motherfucker, man. Like,
I know.
Come on, man. He's the boss, you know, and then that's his name, you know, like, yeah. Dude is the boss. But I mean, Bruce is a great songwriter. He's, I always say that, you know, being a musician, a good musician, is to be able to have the ability to actually touch somebody without physically touching them. Yep. Like to actually move them to tears or whatever. Like you have the ability to take whatever you're feeling, and through your art, through your artistry, you're able to get somebody to understand exactly the way that you feel. Mm-hmm. Like that's a gift. You know, that's something that's very difficult to do. And I saw him when he came, the first time he came to Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, he performed a song, like a new song that he did, and everybody was literally like in tears on the floor. Like people were crying. They were just, people were taken by his songwriting. And to be honest, you know, I didn't like grow up listening to a lot of Bruce Springsteen. Like that wasn't somebody that was like on heavy rotation in my house or even for me. Like I didn't check out all of his records. But then after he was there and we started going through a lot of his music as we were playing it, I decided, like, man, I really need to start checking this guy out because he really has some really great music. And that's when, you know, like when I actually got to play a few songs with him, I started to realize, like, wow, man, this guy, he's a really cool guy. Like, he's good to his band. He's a great leader. He writes great music for them to play, you know, and he treats them well, you know. So that's, you know, rightfully so. He's owned the name, the boss, you know. Like, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Are there any particular challenges as a bass player playing his music? I would think, you know, a certain artist writes a certain way. Is there anything about his music for you as a bass player that was like particularly unique or different or something you hadn't experienced before?
Absolutely. There's to play his music, there's for a lot of different stuff, there's a certain type of feel that had to be captured in a lot of his music. And it was, you know, it was more playing on top of the drums. And
so how would you describe that feel? Like a sort of being ahead of it instead of behind it?
Yeah, kind of being ahead of it, just kind of being like the bass is kind of pushing a lot more than I was like when I'm playing more laid back or hip hop stuff and trying to create a groove like what I do when I'm in my zone, like just kind of playing behind the beat and trying to create some type of groove with the drums. This is a different type of thing. It's more playing ahead of the drums or being right on the drums. The bass is kind of more pushing, you know, so the bass is kind of leading in that respect.
Got it. Well, listen, man, this is really just fascinating stuff to me. I know some of my questions are really like like rudimentary, but I'm that you guys can do what you do and do it at such a high level is amazing to me. And I'd love to talk to you again when you put your album out. I have it come back on, and we'll talk about that. You know.
Okay. Cool.
But the band is Oceanographer. You got working on an album coming out in the spring. You are the bassist for The Roots, and sounds like things are going great for you, man. And you know, we'll keep in touch and get you back on, and we'll talk about the album, and everybody can keep an eye out for you. Are you touring anywhere? You got a tour schedule at all right now?
Right now with the Roots Do, we're taking off to do a little West Coast tour starting on the 27th of December. We're going, we're starting in Seattle. I think we're doing Seattle. We're doing Oakland. We're doing Seattle two nights in Oakland. We're doing Santa Ana, California. And then we're doing somewhere in LA. We're in Vegas on New Year's Eve. And then, we have two more nights in Vegas after that, like the second and the third. We're in Vegas.
You got to do the East Coast, man. I want to catch you on the East Coast.
I know, man. I'm hoping that we'll put together something and finally get to do another East Coast tour. Usually, that's what we do around Christmas time. But the past 2 years, we've been getting away from the East Coast. But you know, I'm sure we're going to get back to the East Coast soon.
All right, cool. This is Mark Kelly, bassist for The Roots and frontman for Oceanographer. Catch him on tour with The Roots. Catch him on TV. Thanks, man. You're awesome.
Thanks a lot, man.
All right, Mark Kelly of The Roots. How cool is that guy? Anything he says is cool. Peanut butter. He just sounds cool saying it. And really, really interesting conversation for me anyway about how that whole bass thing works and what's it like playing in a band and, you know, throwing up with the window up. Been there. I hope you enjoyed it. Tell your friends about the podcast. Spread the word, people. Send the links around. We want to keep blowing this thing up. See you next week.